Welcome to WKY.
Thank you, Mr. Mike. It's just a pleasure to be here, man.
Born in Birmingham, Alabama, and at the age of 13, formed your first band, The Misfits, with a Z.
Oh, yeah, you had to be cool, you know, and change the spelling a little bit and make it different.
Any memories of that?
Oh, lots of memories of that. We had every Friday night we played the YMCA. That was our steady gig, and it was fantastic. You know, what did we play mostly? Well, it was a combination of British Invasion, and of course, never in my wildest dreams did I ever think I would be winding up playing with some of those folks that we were doing the songs of back then. But then we also had a television show, the first local television came to Tuscaloosa. This was in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, by the way. And the first television station came there, and they wanted something modeled on American Bandstand. So we had a local DJ, a guy named Tiger Jack Garrett. And Tiger Jack was the MC, and we were the band, and we very cleverly named the show Tuscaloosa Bandstand.
I played organ and guitar, right?
Well, let's see. I had a Farfisa organ back then, and I did play guitar. And I think eventually I bought a Wurlitzer electric piano, and we put that into the mix a little bit.
When you were 15, moved to Muscle Shoals.
Oh, what a scene it was, man. That area was, for a while, just amazing who it was attracting to come in there. You had people like Aretha Franklin and Wilson Pickett, and you had even the Rolling Stones went there. Bob Dylan went there, Leon Russell, and so many other artists filtered through there. And it was a couple of reasons. One was there was an amazing rhythm section there. They call the Swampers, Muscle Shoals rhythm section. They were studio musicians there.
And speaking of the studio, how did you end up in the famous studios?
Well, you know, when I was probably 15 years old, I realized that Muscle Shoals was the opportunity. That was a place to be, at least in Alabama. And so I had a couple of contacts there. The actual studio that I used to frequent, which was Muscle Shoals Sound, was a very small area, and you know, there wasn't a lot of room for hanging out. So I used to literally sit outside the door and hope that the door would open and I would see my friend that was an engineer there, and you know, have an opportunity to come in, sit down at the piano, play a little bit. Hopefully somebody hear me. Hopefully somebody hire me to play on a record. Eventually that did happen.
And let's see, we got a little snippet of one of your very first recordings. You appeared on this song by Freddie North. Listen to this.
Friend, don't take her, she's all I've got.
Oh, Freddie North, Don't Take Her, She's All I've Got. Tell us about that one. How did you end up on that, and what was that experience like?
That was one of my very first records. That was just a 45. I guess it did wind up on an album, but they released it as a single, and it was a gold record. Very popular. It was covered later by a country artist, and you'll have to help me with who that was. Do you remember, Mike?
No, I don't. I didn't go into that much research, but
I forget who it was, but it was many years later after that. You know, we had a hit on it, and then I think 5 or 6 years went by, and somebody from the country idiom covered that thing and had another hit on it.
He ended up hooking up with Alex Taylor, James Taylor's brother, I believe, and then things kind of opened up for you a little bit. You were recruited by the Allman Brothers. How did that happen? What was that all about?
Recruited. I like that word. Well, what had happened was that I moved to Macon, Georgia, because I had heard about Capricorn Records and Phil Walden, who was the president of the company, and the Allman Brothers band had already been formed and had done their first record. Actually, they had done their second record by the time I went there, which was called Idlewild South. But I had a friend named Paul Hornsby, who used to play in a precursor of the Allman Brothers band, a group called the Hourglass. And Paul and I had been working together in Alabama. The Hourglass had broken up, and he had come back to Alabama where he was from, and we formed a band called the South Camp, and we were hanging out and playing. And anyway, Paul moved over to Macon, Georgia, because he saw opportunity there. And I literally followed Paul over there and started getting into the scene, getting into the studio. I was amazed at the opportunity there. You had a state-of-the-art recording facility back at the time. You're talking about 1969 and 1970. And anyway, as you mentioned, I played with Alex Taylor. After that, played with Dr. John, who was managed by Phil Walden. And that was a great experience for me because I was sort of an apprentice to Mac Rebenack is Dr. John's real name, and learned a lot from Mac. And we all opened up shows for the Allman Brothers Band. So we kind of knew each other. And then when Dwayne had his tragic accident in 71, it was motorcycle accident, and was killed. Big blow to everybody, but of course, no more so than for the band itself. And there was all kind of speculation: who's going to replace Dwayne Allman? And there were people's, you know, Eric Clapton's name was mentioned, Jimmy Page. There were some local guys, and the band did a very gutsy thing. They went out without a replacement, as a five-piece band for a short period of time. I guess it was maybe 4 or 5 months. When they came in off of that experience, which was a very emotional experience, as you can imagine. Mm. Greg wanted to do a solo record. Well, I was called to do that. And in the process, these impromptu jam sessions went down where some of the other members of the Allman Brothers would come down, Dickie and Butch Trucks and J-Mo and Barry Oakley. And we would just have these impromptu, informal jam sessions. And, man, they started feeling really good. So about 2 or 3 weeks after this, I got a call. Can you come down to the offices of the record company? Yes, I went in, and there's all the band, Phil Walden, and after a few pleasantries, the shoe dropped, and how would you like to be in the band? And you could have knocked me over with a feather, I promise you. I had just barely turned 20 years old, yeah. And it was a great surprise for me.
Let's talk about this little piano solo here.
Oh, yes.
Who doesn't remember this? Of course, a little ditty right there in the middle of Jessica from Brothers and Sisters. Tell us about coming up with that riff, that solo. Was it something that just happened? Something you worked on?
No, it was an improvised solo. Dickie brought the song to the band, played it to us on acoustic guitar. He had been listening to Django Reinhardt records, yeah. And he had been watching his young daughter at the time, Jessica, who was about 2 years old. Play around the house, and you know, he came up with that jangly kind of intro that he had, and you know, we all contributed to the arrangement. We would play the song, and then we'd leave it alone for a night, and we'd maybe take it up the next night. And I guess after 4 or 5 nights of this, we finally had the full arrangement from beginning to end, and began recording in earnest. And wow, it was just a great experience. You know, thank you, Dickie, for writing a song that gives me such a great vehicle to play on.
Then you started these immense tours with the Rolling Stones, and you've actually been referred to as the sixth Rolling Stone. Goodness gracious, I got 1,000 questions about that, but why don't you go ahead and just something off the cuff. Tell me about your experience with the Rolling Stones.
Well, the gig came about because of a fellow named Bill Graham. Mike, you'll probably remember that name. Mm-hmm. Bill was known as the impresario of rock. Amazing character, and he had the Fillmore East and the Fillmore West clubs, very famous clubs back in the 60s. And he also managed a lot of artists, including Carlos Santana and some others. But he was just a proponent of this music, and he loved it, and he promoted it. And a lot of artists are in his debt. Well, anyway, he loved the Allman Brothers Band, and I think he looked at a piano player coming into the Allman Brothers with some skepticism. This is a guitar band. What's a piano player doing there? Well, anyway, I seem to have won him over, and we became good friends, and he promoted the Allmans, and then he helped me with my band Sea Level. And then fast forward, I hadn't seen him in a number of years. In 1981, he became tour director, which was kind of a new moniker, for the Rolling Stones, basically meaning that he arranged all of the shows, went on tour with the band, and just looked after the whole shebang. And so as this was going down, they had recorded the Tattoo You record. Start Me Up was the big single off of that. And they were preparing to go on tour, and I guess Mick and Keith wanted to try some different folks in the band. And Bill, God rest his soul, he was killed in a helicopter crash many years ago now. But Bill suggested my name, so they called me. I went up on a moment's notice. I found out about this, and literally in 2 days I was on a plane to go audition, and it worked out, and here I am, 26 years later.
I understand you'd already developed a relationship with the Rolling Stones piano player and road manager Ian Stewart, right?
Well, we met during that process, and Stu was just – so wonderful, man. For your listeners that don't know the history of Ian Stewart, he was actually one of the founding members of the Rolling Stones. But one of their early managers, a guy named Andrew Lug Oldham, figured that he didn't really look the part and that there was going to be too many principal members to have six people in the band. So he was politely asked not to be in the band, but asked to stay on and perform functions as a road manager, logistician, and still to play on the records and sometimes to play live as well. But so he took that rather well, and he agreed that that's what he would do. And, you know, time went on, and they had, as you know, other keyboard players throughout the career. You had people like Nicky Hopkins playing beautifully on some of those records. You had Billy Preston in the band. You had Ian McClagan. Well, anyway, when they called me, Stu was the contact. Stu called me and arranged for me to come up there. He met me at the airport, took me to the audition. We became instant friends, and I learned a lot from Stu. Stu was a fanatic for boogie-woogie piano playing. I mean, like, you know, he had, you know, these wonderful left-hand figures that, you know, I wanted to learn. So he turned me on to all these artists like Mead Lux Lewis and Montana Taylor and Pete Johnson and Albert Ammons and these really fantastic boogie-woogie piano players. And we spent a lot of time together, and he would show me things, and we would listen to records together and so forth. So we became very tight.
You know, it's interesting. I watched the Martin Scorsese film Shine a Light. It appeared in one particular scene that you were actually giving Mick Jagger instruction during one of the rehearsals.
I tell him everything, yeah. Mike. You know, he doesn't make a move without me. He calls me every day. Well, what should I do now, Chuck? No, man, you know, through the years, my role with the band has sort of morphed and evolved. And so now, you know, I take on certain responsibilities. I mean, when we're rehearsing, I keep kind of meticulous notes about the rehearsals and what we did and if we changed anything in the arrangement, and I document that. And so they're, you know, Mick and Keith, who have written, what, 500-odd songs, can barely remember any of them. So, you know, Keith will look at them, what key is that? What key is it in? Could you just tell me what key? You know, what's the bridge? How's it go? What's the intro? You know, so
well, it's got to be just a ton of fun. You finished this, what was it, 2-year tour, the most recent one with the Rolling Stones?
2 years exactly, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah,
and sure it ended in Europe, mm-hmm. And as a result of that, you found yourself in Germany, I understand. Is that correct, or somewhere in Europe?
Yeah, well...
And the idea came to you to put together this live recording. Tell us about that.
Right, well, what happened was for a number of years through my conservation efforts, as you mentioned, my wife, Rose Lane, and I... own a 2,500-acre tree farm, and we've been involved in forestry and advocates of conservation issues for a long, long time now. Well, anyway, we've made connections in Germany with landowners there and people that are involved in forestry and other environmental efforts. And so I've been approached years ago to would I consider doing a tour that would, you know, we would play some music and have some fun, but also do some public relations concerning these issues. And for one reason or another, it just never worked out. And this time around, it did. So we finished up in Europe with the Rolling Stones in London, and we arranged, my friends and I arranged this tour to do mostly Germany right after the Stones tour. And it just worked out very, very well. So I stayed on for a month and did these dates and you know, did a lot of interviews and went to the Bundestag and talked policy to some of the leaders there, and just had a great experience. And in the process, we did this live radio broadcast with these fabulous German musicians that backed me up. They were just great, man. They were so talented and fast learners. We only had like two rehearsals and then a couple of gigs, and then we did this broadcast. And it just turned out so well, Mike, I couldn't help it. I had to put it out. So that's what it is, called Live in Germany, double disc CD, and it's just been out about a month or so.
Yeah, Live in Germany, Green Leaves and Blue Notes, I think, is the full title of it. It's the end result. 18 songs on this record. Why don't you play something? Maybe I think you were rehearsing something that doesn't actually appear on the CD.
I'll do something that's not on the CD.
There
How
you
about
go.
That? Why not?
Ladies and gentlemen, Chuck Lavelle live on WUKY.
Well, here's a tune, Mike, that we did on the Eric Clapton Unplugged record many years ago, and great pleasure to work with Eric. He was just a wonderful man to be with and to work with in the band. So this is called Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out. Once I lived the life of a millionaire, I spent all my money, I just didn't have a care. I took my friends out for a mighty good time. I bought bootleg liquor, champagne and wine. Then I began to fall so low, lost all my money, I had nowhere to go. If I get my hands on a dollar again, I'm gonna hold on to it till that old eagle grin. Cause nobody knows you when you're down and out. In your pocket, you don't have a penny. And as for friends, you just don't have any. And when you get back on your feet again, everybody wants to be your long lost friend. I said it's strange, without any doubt, nobody knows you when you're down and out. You don't have a penny, oh, oh. And as for friends, you just don't have any. And when you get back on your feet again, you know everybody wants to be your long lost friend. I said it's strange, without any doubt. Look out, nobody wants to know you. Seem like nobody want to know you. Nobody wants to know you when you're down and out. All right.
Chuck Lavelle, he's live on WUKY. We're NPR Rocks at 91.3. He's got the live album out. It's called Live in Germany, Green Leaves and Blue Notes. Chuck, thank you so much for stopping by the radio station and performing live for us and all of our listeners here.
Great pleasure to be with you.